Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, and I also post it on our social medium, which is pyvil.net, and which you are welcome to join. Today we're going to do three more stories from the one and only Hector Hugh Munroe, better known as Saki. And I hold in my hand the Wordsworth Classics, a cheap paper, soft cover collection of his stories, which claims to be the complete stories. Got a collection the other day of O. Henry. I always like to get the complete ones. So we'll do three, let's say. We'll start with Mrs. Packletide's Tiger. Packletide's. Mrs. Packletide's Tiger. It was Mrs. Packletide's pleasure and intention that she should shoot a tiger. Not that the lust to kill had suddenly descended on her, or that she felt that she would leave India safer and more wholesome than she found it, with one fraction less of a wild beast per million of inhabitants. The compelling motive for her sudden deviation towards the footsteps of Nimrod was the fact that Loons Bimberton had recently been carried 11 miles in an aeroplane by an Algerian aviator and talked of nothing else. Only a personally procured tiger skin and a heavy harvest of press photographs could successfully counter that sort of thing. So she's doing it for social reasons. Mrs. Packletide had already arranged in her mind the lunch she would give at her house in Curzon Street, ostensibly in Luna Bimberton's honor, with a tiger skin rug occupying most of the foreground in all of the conversation. She had also already designed in her mind the tiger claw brooch that she was going to give Luna Bimberton on her next birthday. In a world that is supposed to be chiefly swayed by hunger and by love, Mrs. Packletide was an exception. Her movements and motives were largely governed by dislike of Luna Bimberton. Circumstances proved propitious. Mrs. Packletide had offered 1,000 rupees for the opportunity of shooting a tiger without overmuch risk or exertion, and it so happened that a neighboring village could boast of being the favored rendezvous of an animal of respectable antecedents, which had been driven by the increasing infirmities of age to abandon game-killing and confine its appetite to the smaller domestic animals. The prospect of earning the 1,000 rupees had stimulated the sporting and commercial instinct of the villagers. Children were posted night and day on the outskirts of the local jungle to head the tiger back in the unlikely event of his attempting to roam away to fresh hunting grounds, and the cheaper kind of goats were left about with elaborate carelessness to keep him satisfied with his present quarters. The one great anxiety was lest he should die of old age before the date appointed for the Memsahib shoot. Mothers carrying their babies home through the jungle after the day's work in the fields hushed their singing lest they might curtail the restful sleep of the venerable herd robber. The great night duly arrived, moonlit and cloudless. A platform had been constructed in a comfortable and conveniently placed tree, and thereon crouched Mrs. Packletide and her paid companion, Miss Mebbin. A goat, gifted with a particularly persistent bleat, such as even a partially deaf tiger might be reasonably expected to hear on a still night, was tethered at the correct distance. With an accurately sighted rifle and a thumbnail pack of patience cards, the sportswoman awaited the coming of the quarry. "I suppose we are in some danger," said Miss Mebbin. She was not actually nervous about the wild beast, but she had a morbid dread of performing an atom more service than she had been paid for. "Nonsense," said Mrs. Packletide. "It's a very old tiger. It couldn't spring up here even if it wanted to." "If it's an old tiger, I think you ought to get it cheaper. 1,000 rupees is a lot of money." Louisa Mebbin adopted a protective elder sister attitude towards money in general, irrespective of nationality or denomination. Her energetic intervention had saved many a ruble from dissipating itself in tips in some Moscow hotel. I.e., it's his clever way of saying she stole tips. She's a tip thief. And francs and centimes clung to her instinctively under circumstances which would have driven them headlong from less sympathetic hands. Her speculations as to the market depreciation of tiger remnants were cut short by the appearance on the scene of the animal itself. As soon as it caught sight of the tethered goat, it lay flat on the earth, seemingly less from a desire to take advantage of all available cover than for the purpose of snatching a short rest before commencing the grand attack. "I believe it's ill," said Louisa Mebbin, loudly in Hindustani, for the benefit of the village headman, who was in ambush in a neighboring tree. "Hush!" said Mrs. Packletide, and at that moment the tiger commenced ambling towards his victim. "Now, now," urged Miss Mebbin with some excitement, "if he doesn't touch the goat, we needn't pay for it." The bait was extra, or an extra. The rifle flashed out with a loud report, and the great tawny beast sprang to one side and then rolled over in the stillness of death. In a moment, a crowd of excited natives had swarmed onto the scene, and their shouting speedily carried the glad news to the village, where a thumping of tom-toms took up the chorus of triumph. And their triumph and rejoicing found a ready echo in the heart of Mrs. Packletide. Already that luncheon party in Curzon Street seemed immeasurably nearer. My apologies if I'm mispronouncing. I don't know if it's Curzon or Curzon. It's a very famous name in English. I can't tell you why. I think he was some foreign diplomat, but I'm not sure I'm placing the announce or the accent correctly. But either way, C-U-R-Z-O-N, very English, English name. It was Louisa Mebbin who drew attention to the fact that the goat was in death throes from a mortal bullet wound, while no trace of the rifle's deadly work could be found in the tiger. Evidently, the wrong animal had been hit, and the beast of prey had succumbed to a heart failure caused by the sudden report of the rifle, accelerated by senile decay. Mrs. Packletide was pardonably annoyed at the discovery, but at any rate, she was the possessor of a dead tiger, and the villagers, anxious for their 1,000 rupees, gladly connived at the fiction that she had shot the beast. And Miss Mebbin was a paid companion. Therefore, did Miss Packleton face the cameras with a light heart, and her pictured fame reached from the pages of the Texas Weekly Snapshot to the illustrated Monday supplement of the Novo Vremya. As for Luna Bimberton, she refused to look at an illustrated paper for weeks, and her letter of thanks for the gift of a tiger claw brooch was a model of repressed emotions. So say he's stating things slyly and backwards in the way of a satirist. So these women trying to upstage each other is his theme, and throughout much of his writing. So it's about kind of social manners. The luncheon party, she declined. There are limits beyond which repressed emotions become dangerous. So she does not want to be upstaged in public by this goat shooter, pretending to be a tiger killer. From Curzon Street and the tiger skin rug, or the tiger skin rug, traveled down to the manor house and was duly inspected and admired by the county. And it seemed a fitting and appropriate thing when Mrs. Packletide went to the county costume ball in the character of Diana, remember the Greek god on the hunt. She refused to fall in, however, with Clovis's tempting suggestion, and remember we're in the Clovis section of this now. She refused to fall in, however, with Clovis's tempting suggestion of a primeval dance party at which everyone should wear the skins of beasts they had recently slain. "I should be in a rather baby bunting condition," confessed Clovis, "with a miserable rabbit skin or two to wrap up in. But then," he added with a rather malicious glance at Diana's proportions, "my figure is quite as good as that Russian dancing boy's." Again, we're dealing with small, thin. Remember, the English upper class has always been associated with thinness, sort of a prominent thin nose, thin lips, and a sort of receding chin. It's outlined in Class by Paul Fussell. Anyway, so he's doing the young queer thing, except back then you can't be 100% sure. They always had to disguise it. Sodomy was against the law back then. How amused, and remember, he isn't, to some extent, a knockoff Wilde. How amused everyone would be if they knew what really happened, said Louisa Mebbin a few days after the ball. What do you mean? asked Mrs. Packletide quickly. "How you shot the goat and frightened the tiger to death," said Miss Mebbin, with her disagreeably pleasant laugh. "No one would believe it," said Mrs. Packletide, her face changing color as rapidly as though it were going through a book of patterns before post time, reference to her losing a horse racing, and the jockey silks that they wear. "Luna Bimberton would," said Miss Mebbin. So this scheming, miserly, tip-stealing broad who was paid to help her is basically going to blackmail her. She loves money that much into not telling her social competitor the real story. "No one would believe it," said Mrs. Packletide, her face changing color as rapidly as though it were going through a book of patterns before post time. "Luna Bimberton would," said Miss Mebbin. Mrs. Packletide's face settled on an unbecoming shade of greenish white. "You surely wouldn't give me away?" she asked. "I've seen a weekend cottage near Dorking that I should rather like to buy," said Miss Mebbin with seeming irrelevance. 680, freehold. Quite a bargain. Only I don't happen to have the money." Blank line. End. Louisa Mebbin's pretty weekend cottage, christened by her Les Fauves, and gay in summertime with its garden borders of tiger lilies, is the wonder and admiration of her friends. And I'm trying to remember and irritated with myself what Fauves mean. Does it mean purple or does it mean fawns? I'm not sure. I'm going to look it up, though. "It is a marvel of how Louisa manages to do it," is the general verdict. Mrs. Packletide, how she acquired this nice cottage. Mrs. Packletide indulges in no more big game shooting. "The incidental expenses are so heavy," she confides to inquiring friends. "I think that's an exceptionally good short story. Been showing what the English are like, or maybe what people are like generally, how pretentious they are, and how they intend to do one thing and ends up doing something else, which, as I have told you, is the master theme of the universe. Best symbolized by the yin-yang symbol. You try to do one thing and it produces the opposite result. Now, the Catholic will say we have free will and we do evil, but God brings good from the evil since he can't interfere with our free will, which is not Occam's way of simplifying. I would simply point out that if the world were designed, it would be designed by an ironist. Or as I've said, it really reminds me of the eye doctor in this or this. You think you see this, but let me show you this. Let me show you this from a 2-degree difference. Is that better? And a lot of times, oh my God, it is a better way of looking at the world. It's better than my understanding. And I was so vociferous. I had such a strong opinion, and now I'm shown that oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. And this is why literature and reading it and understanding it, apart from it's just being delightful. And when he's saying it indirectly and subtly and satirically, writing about these women. And again, these are the things that men generally don't notice in women, except for queers or men who are literary or who make it their special dedication. To the other ones, their heads are filled with musk as they're lusting after women, but they're not really paying attention to them. That's why women are so, their whole business in life is attracting men. If you look at the layout of their body. And mentally, they're geared entirely to manipulating them since they're smaller. So only a minority of men actually pays attention to women at a close enough level to actually see what they're doing. But I thought that was actually one of the best stories. And these are really almost more slices that had a bit more meat to it than some of these, perhaps. But they're all very much in the same vein. We will do two more, but first I want to look up Les Fauves. I'm not even going to pretend to you. See, I could halt it and look it up. For some reason, I'm thinking it means purple, but purple or violet. But then again, I'm thinking it might mean fawns. Probably it means neither. Just a minute. Okay, and it means the wild beasts, literally. But I should have remembered, because I have done some art history, that it's a school of fauvism. It's a school of painting. I want to see how it's described, which I'd utterly forgotten until I read this. The name Les Fauves, F-A-U-V-E-S, the wild beast, was coined by the critic Louis Vaucelles when he saw the work of Henri Matisse and André Drain in an exhibition in the Salon d'Automne, the fall salon in Paris in 1905. So again, that would be right around the time this was being written. And so if she calls the cottage she got by blackmail the wild beast, it's a nice joke that will forever be a burr under the saddle of the goat shooter. So all in all, a lot to learn and just wonderful stuff. And now we will move along to story number two. Next story is The Stampeding of Lady Bastable. Bastable, I don't know. I'm going to say Bastable. It would be rather nice if you had put Clovis up for another 6 days while I go up north to the McGregors, said Mrs. Sangrail sleepily across the breakfast table. It was her invariable plan to speak in a sleepy, comfortable voice whenever she was unusually keen about anything. It put people off their guard, and they frequently fell in with her wishes before they had realized she was really asking for anything. So again, notice that's a constant theme of his work, how people are deceiving and others and the cunning and lying in wait for them and practicing stratagems and being the opposite of direct. Lady Bastable, however, was not so easily taken unawares. Possibly she knew that voice and what it betokened. At any rate, she knew Clovis. I'm going to make another comment on his style, too. He used two semicolons. I was going to mention that last story. He used two semicolons, always correctly, of course, in the first paragraph of the last story, and the same here. He uses the semicolon all the time. She frowned at a piece of toast and ate it very slowly, as though she wished to convey the impression that the process hurt her more than it hurt the toast. But no extension of hospitality on Clovis's behalf rose to her lips. And he's there saying that she's reacting, she's trying to show that she's not happy that because what she put out was not returned the way she desired. It would be of great convenience to me, pursued Mrs. Sangrail, abandoning the careless tone. I particularly don't want to take him to the McGregors, and it will only be for 6 days. It will seem longer, said Lady Bastable dismally. The last time he stayed here for a week. I know, interrupted the other hastily, but that was nearly 2 years ago. He was younger then. But he hasn't improved, said her hostess. It's no use growing older if you only learn new ways of misbehaving yourself. Mrs. Sangrail was unable to argue the point. Since Clovis had reached the age of 17, she had never ceased to bewail his irrepressible waywardness to all her circle of acquaintances, and a polite skepticism would have greeted the slightest hint at a prospective reformation. She discarded the fruitless effort at cajolery and resorted to undisguised bribery. If you'll have him here for these 6 days, I'll cancel that outstanding bridge account. It was only for 49 shillings, but Lady Bastable loved shillings with a great, strong love. Now, again, just like the last story, we see a character is entirely motivated by money. Love of money is very, very English in that. To lose money at bridge and not to have to pay it was one of those rare experiences which gave the card table a glamour in her eyes which it could never otherwise have possessed. So like a Jewish bankster, she can only win and not lose if her debts are going to be forgiven and bailed out by the host or the government. Mrs. Sangrail was almost equally devoted to her card winnings, but the prospect of conveniently warehousing her offspring for 6 days and incidentally saving his railway fare to the north reconciled her to the sacrifice, semicolon. When Clovis made a belated appearance at the breakfast table, the bargain had been struck. Just think, said Mrs. Sangrail sleepily. Lady Bastable has very kindly asked you to stay on here while I go to the McGregors. And again, notice how she's overtly lying. These people are continually lying, continually misrepresenting. And this actually is the heart of English culture, I would say. He's not making fun of these people. These are the people as he actually finds them. This is not caricature. This is how they actually are and operate, says I. So, Clovis said suitable things in a highly unsuitable manner, and proceeded to make punitive expeditions among the breakfast dishes with a scowl on his face that would have driven the purr out of a peace conference. The arrangement that had been concluded behind his back was doubly distasteful to him. In the first place, he particularly wanted to teach the McGregor boys, who could well afford the knowledge, of how to play poker patience, which I guess is a card game, hyphenated, Poker Patience. Secondly, the Bastable catering was of the kind that is classified as a rude plenty, which Clovis translated as a plenty that gives rise to rude remarks. I guess rude plenty, I'm guessing and probably wrong. That would mean a lot of stuff, but not very good quality, like a lot of bread or something. Watching him from behind, ostentatiously sleepy lids. So again, she's putting out the show that she's not caring, but actually she's very intent to get something across, as with the woman she made the deal with. His mother realized, in the light of long experience, that any rejoicing over the success of her maneuver would be distinctly premature. It was one thing to fit Clovis into a convenient niche of the domestic jigsaw puzzle, semicolon. It was quite another matter to get him to stay there. It's practically his entire writing technique. Is this semicolon? Lady Bastable was wont to retire in state to the morning room immediately after breakfast and spend a quiet hour in skimming through the papers. They were there, so she might as well get their money's worth out of them. Politics did not greatly interest her, but she was obsessed with a favorite foreboding that one of these days there would be a great social upheaval in which everybody would be killed by everybody else. "It will come sooner than we think," she would observe darkly. A mathematical expert of exceptionally high powers would have been puzzled to work out the approximate date from the slender and confusing groundwork which this assertion afforded. So we see that the doomsters are with us always, as I read this in the time of Corona. On this particular morning, the sight of Lady Bastable enthroned among her papers gave Clovis the hint towards which his mind had been groping all breakfast time. His mother had gone upstairs to supervise packing operations, and he was alone on the ground floor with his hostess and the servants. The latter were the key to the situation. Bursting wildly into the kitchen quarters, Clovis screamed a frantic, though strictly noncommittal, summons. "Poor Lady Bastable, in the morning room. Oh, quick!" The next moment, the butler, cook, page boy, two or three maids, and a gardener, who had happened to be in one of the outer kitchens, were following in a hot scurry after Clovis as he headed back for the morning room. Lady Bastable was roused from the world of newspaper lore by hearing a Japanese screen in the hall go down with a crash. Then the door leading from the hall flew open, and her young guest tore madly through the room, shrieked at her in passing, "The Jacquerie! They're on to us! Or they're on us!" and dashed like an escaping hawk out through the French window. The scared mob of servants burst in on his heels, the gardener still clutching the sickle with which he had been trimming the hedges, and the impetus of their headlong haste carried them, slipping and sliding, over the smooth parquet flooring towards the chair where their mistress sat in panic-stricken amazement. If she had had a moment granted her for reflection, she would have behaved, as she afterwards explained, with considerable dignity. It was probably the sickle which decided her. But anyway, she followed the lead that Clovis had given her through the French window and ran well and far across the lawn before the eyes of her astonished retainers. She took fright and took flight. Lost dignity is not a possession which can be restored at a moment's notice, and both Lady Bastable and the butler found the process of returning to normal conditions almost as painful as a slow recovery from drowning. A Jacquerie, even if carried out with the most respectful of intentions, cannot fail to leave some traces of embarrassment behind it. By lunchtime, however, decorum had reasserted itself with enhanced rigor as a natural rebound from its recent overthrow, and the meal was served in a frigid stateliness that might have been framed on a Byzantine model. Halfway through its duration, Mrs. Sangrail was solemnly presented with an envelope lying in a silver salver. It contained a check for 49 shillings. The McGregor boys learned how to play Poker Patience after all. They could afford to. So, Clovis is such an obnoxious little jerk that 49 shillings does not make up for having to put up with him for 6/7 of a week. Now, let's look up Jacquerie. Okay, they're pronouncing it Jacquerie, and it refers to a peasant revolt in 1358 in the Hundred Years' War. The revolt was centered in the valley of Oise, O-I-S-E, north of Paris, and was suppressed after a few weeks of violence. A popular revolt by peasants that took place in northern France in the early summer of 1358 during the Hundred Years' War. Jacquerie. J-A-C-Q-U-E-R-I-E. That's the second story, and now we'll do one more. The Background is the name of our final story for today. That woman's art jargon tires me, said Clovis to his journalist friend. She's so fond of talking of certain pictures as, quote, growing on one, as though they were a sort of fungus. Isn't it funny that common expression talked about over 100 years ago? That reminds me, said the journalist, of the story of Henri Depuis. Have I ever told it you? Clovis shook his head. Henri Depuis, H-E-N-R-I-D-E-P-L-I-S, Henri Depuis was, by birth, a native of the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. On mature reflection, he became a commercial traveler. His business activities frequently took him beyond the limits of the Grand Duchy, and he was stopping in a small town of northern Italy when news reached him from home that a legacy from a distant and deceased relative had fallen to his share. He inherited something. It was not a large legacy, even from a modest standpoint of Henri Depuis, but it impelled him towards some seemingly harmless extravagances. In particular, it led him to patronize local art as represented by the tattoo needles of Signor Andreas Pincini. Signor Pincini, P-I-N-C-I-N-I, was perhaps the most brilliant master of tattoo craft that Italy had ever known, but his circumstances were decidedly impoverished, and for the sum of 600 francs he gladly undertook to cover his client's back, from the collarbone down to the waistline, with a glowing representation of the fall of Icarus. Remember, he was the one who flew too close to the sun, and his wings melted. The design, when finally developed, was a slight disappointment to Monsieur Depuis, who had suspected Icarus of being a fortress taken by Wallenstein in the 30 Years' War, so he didn't know the myth background. But he was more than satisfied with the execution of the work, which was acclaimed by all who had the privilege of seeing it as Pincini's masterpiece. It was his greatest effort and his last. Without even waiting to be paid, the illustrious craftsman departed this life and was buried under an ornate tombstone whose winged cherubs would have afforded singularly little scope for the exercise of his favorite art. There remained, however, the widow Pincini, to whom this 600 francs was due, or were due, and thereupon arose the great crisis in the life of Henri Depuis, traveler of commerce. The legacy, under the stress of numerous little calls on its substance, had dwindled to a very insignificant proportions, and when a pressing wine bill and sundry other current accounts had been paid, there remained little more than 430 francs to offer to the widow. The lady was properly indignant, not wholly, as she volubly explained, on account of the suggested writing off of 170 francs, but also at the attempt to depreciate the value of her late husband's acknowledged masterpiece. What? You want to pay me off 430? Everyone says it's a masterpiece. He's dead. You owe this. Pay it. In a week's time, Depuis was obliged to reduce his offer to 405 francs, which circumstance fanned the widow's indignation into fury. She canceled the sale of the work of art. So do you see what maybe he's doing to turn on the Merchant of Venice here with the pound of flesh? That's what someone who's educated might immediately suspect reading that, where if you're looking at the production values, where the writer might be headed. He might, this is the way originality works. Someone reads something from someone else that they may well have got from other people. Shakespeare used plots that certainly were not his own, but he gave them his own twist. And that's what a lot of originality is. And here we might be just a speculation. I don't know, but we'll see how it goes forward. That's certainly one way you could envision it. If she intends to take the debt back in the form of flesh, would he may have got that idea from Shakespeare? Quite possibly. She canceled the sale of the work of art, and a few days later, Depuis learned with a sense of consternation that she had presented it to the municipality of Bergamo, which had gratefully accepted it. He left the neighborhood as unobtrusively as possible. Mencken would have said, slipped out of town between days. He loved to say between days. Means at night. It's a way of saying at night, where he hoped his identity and that of the famous picture might be lost sight of. But he bore on his back the burden of the dead man's genius. On presenting himself one day in the steaming corridor of a vapor bath, he was at once hustled back into his clothes by the proprietor, who was a North Italian and who emphatically refused to allow the celebrated Fall of Icarus to be publicly on view without the permission of the municipality of Bergamo. Public interest and official vigilance increased as the matter became more widely known, and Dupuis was unable to take a simple dip in the sea or river on the hottest afternoon unless clothed up to the collarbone in a substantial bathing garment. Later on, the authorities of Bergamo conceived the idea that salt water might be injurious to the masterpiece, and a perpetual injunction was obtained which debarred the muchly harassed commercial traveler from sea bathing under any circumstance. Altogether, he was fervently thankful when his firm of employers found him a new range of activities in the neighborhood of Bordeaux, French area again. His thankfulness, however, ceased abruptly at the Franco-Italian frontier. An imposing array of official force barred his departure, and he was sternly reminded of the stringent law which forbids the exportation of Italian works of art. A diplomatic parley ensued between the Luxembourgian and Italian government, and at one time the European situation became overcast with the possibilities of trouble. So like the War of Jenkins' Ear, a real European war, there could have been the War of Dupuis' Back. But the Italian government stood firm. It declined to concern itself in the least with the fortunes or even the existence of Henri Dupuis, commercial traveler, but was immovable in its decision that the Fall of Icarus, by the late Pincini, Andreas, at present the property of the municipality of Bergamo, should not leave the country. The excitement died down in time, but the unfortunate Dupuis, who was of a constitutionally retiring disposition, found himself a few months later once more the storm center of a furious controversy. A certain German art expert, who had obtained from the municipality of Bergamo permission to inspect the famous masterpiece, declared it to be a spurious Pincini, probably the work of some pupil whom he had employed in his declining years. The evidence of Dupuis on the subject was obviously worthless, as he had been under the influence of the customary narcotics during the long process of pricking in the design. Again, a tattoo painting. The editor of an Italian art journal refuted the contentions of the German expert and undertook to prove that his private life did not conform to any modern standard of decency. The whole of Italy and Germany were drawn into the dispute, and the rest of Europe was soon involved in the quarrel. There were stormy scenes in the Spanish Parliament, and the University of Copenhagen bestowed a gold medal on the German expert, afterwards sending a commission to examine his proofs on the spot, while two Polish schoolboys in Paris committed suicide to show what they thought of the matter. Now, I'm almost certain he is making an analogy to either World War I, which is about to happen, or I think it's written before that, or something else that I'm not quite aware of, but just to show how they're drawn into some dumb dispute. Meanwhile, the unhappy human background fared no better than before, and it was not surprising that he drifted into the ranks of Italian anarchists. Four times, at least, he was escorted to the frontier as a dangerous and undesirable foreigner, but he was always brought back as the Fall of Icarus, attributed to Pincini, Andreas, early 20th century. He could also just be mocking art provenance disputes more generally. Provenance, the sort of pedigree, the word used with wine and paintings more than any other word, but also a wonderful, marvelous word for satire. I use it a lot myself. When it's the high thing of a provenance, like some marvelous work of art applied to a very low subject, it's particularly funny. The provenance of the slug that occupied my dining bowl, you know, something like that, if you're eating at a French restaurant. And then one day, at an anarchist congress at Genoa, a fellow worker, in the heat of debate, broke a vial, P-H-I-A-L, full of corrosive liquid over his back. The red shirt that he was wearing mitigated the effects, but the Icarus was ruined beyond recognition. His assailant was severely reprimanded for assaulting a fellow anarchist and received 7 years imprisonment for defacing a national art treasure. As soon as he was able to leave the hospital, Henri Dupuis was put across the frontier as an undesirable alien. In the quieter streets of Paris, especially in the neighborhood of the Ministry of Fine Arts, You may sometimes meet a depressed, anxious-looking man who, if you pass him the time of the day, will answer you with a slight Luxembourgian accent. He nurses the illusion that he is one of the lost arms of the Venus de Milo and hopes that the French government may be persuaded to buy him. On all other subjects, I believe, he is tolerably sane. And again, that story was called The Background, so it's almost making fun of Providence generally. And it would be funny to make fun of the Providence without A, ever mentioning the term, dealing with what it, the contents of its meaning, or rather than the actual term, and then using the synonym background, which is a common, not to say vulgar term for the high-toned, tony, posh, as the English would say, provenance. Now, that's where we'll leave it today with those three wonderful stories. And I want to thank you for being with me, and I will be back with you again real, real soon with more from the collected stories of Saki, who is Hector Hugh Munroe.